Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we are going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever. Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
All right, so Marco.
Sean.
Do you have any money in your wallet?
I can't use them.
You can't use the money? You know, I was thinking about this morning. I haven't actually touched money in a long time. That's a different topic, but...
That's a completely different topic. I was making a joke about not being able to pay things with it, but yeah, you made a really, really good point.
Yes, and not going to hold your dog for ransom, but maybe your computer.
Go for it.
And that's probably going to work because it seems to be working all over the place. And that's kind of the topic today. This is part of our on-location where we work with our media partner. In this case, it's RSA Conference, to talk about things happening around the world in information security and privacy. And today's topic is ransomware.
Yep. Definitely a topic that has been growing and growing and growing. And that's not exactly the direction we would want it to see. We would like to see it leaving, but with people working from home and people taking advantage, and by people I mean cyber criminal taking advantage
and
of
dogs.
These and dogs. But you know, as you say, on the internet, you don't know if you're a dog or not.
Exactly,
so that's another question.
All right, so no dogs here today that I can see. Only amazing people, and I'm going to take a moment to do a quick round of hellos, and then ask each of our guests to say a few words. We have Kathleen Lotriante, Adam Hickey, and Stuart Baker. Thank you all for joining us.
Great to be here.
And Kathleen, I'm going to lead it off with you. A few words about what you're up to, and then we'll pass it over to Adam.
Sure. I teach at Georgetown University, typically international law, national security policy, and cyber policy. I'm also affiliated with the CSIS, a think tank in Washington, D.C. I'm a senior advisor there. Most of my background, having worked for the government a number of years, transitioning into academia, I focus on technology, particularly cyber, write and publish on both domestic and international law and policy issues.
Adam.
Good afternoon. I'm a lawyer in the Justice Department. I'm one of the managers of the National Security Division. I focus on our counterintelligence portfolio and specifically state-sponsored threats to the private sector. So that includes cyber threats, including ransomware.
Perfect. And last but certainly not least, Stuart.
Hi, Sean. I'm a recovering government official. I worked at NSA and DHS, but I practice law when I'm not in government, and I'm doing that again. And to keep my policy hand in, I do a weekly cyber law podcast. So it's a pleasure to be talking to you in this context.
Perfect. Thrilled to have you all on.
Yeah, that's it's an honor, and also the beginning of what I believe to be a very interesting conversation, because of course, as Sean says, we're talking about ransomware today, and the numbers are definitely not looking too good lately. And I would like to start with Adam, maybe, to give a little bit of a picture of how this ransomware problem is affecting not only business, but society in general.
Sure. So even before the pandemic, I think we were seeing very steep increases in the deployment of ransomware, the extent to which people were getting infected, entities were getting infected, and also the extent to which they were paying. And when you add the pandemic on top of that, you see actors targeting the healthcare sector disproportionately, and state and local governments both because I think they offer critical services and because they're more likely to pay, in part because of that criticality. So in the last year, especially, I think we've noticed just how acute this threat is from the standpoint of national security and critical infrastructure.
So Stuart, I want to turn to you because I've had this question for a long time, is why is this still a problem, right? It seems to be a problem and continues to grow as a problem. And I'm wondering we have this directive to not pay the ransom. And I can understand how that might work because we're not then fueling the machine that creates and exacerbates the problem. Is that the answer to this problem, or are there other ways we should be looking at it?
Well, of course, the answer would be it would be great if nobody paid the ransom. But asking people who need their data and who are under extortion threats that all of their data not only will be denied to them, but will be released to the world with embarrassing consequences, asking them to take on the burden of that sacrifice with the hope that everybody else will do the same and that'll solve the problem, it's just not a realistic thing to ask of individual human beings. So that's the problem, is that somebody who's ransomwared has to make a decision in 48, 72 hours. Saying if it's the wrong sort of ransomware gang, you simply can't pay them, imposes a pretty heavy burden on those individuals.
Well, it sure is a problem to do it, and it's a problem not to do it. So,
exactly.
Catherine, what's your take on this?
So, you know, I thought about this after we did our recording. I thought some more about the conversation I had with Adam and Stuart, and it reminds me of kind of the long term versus short term approach to looking at problems. And I understand from the Department of Treasury's perspective of the U.S. government, what they want to do with this new guidance, letting people know that if you're providing money to ransomware criminals and they happen to be on the sanctions list, whether you knew it or not, you know, you're going to be in trouble and you're going to be in violation of our mandate. And I understand from the government's perspective that it's what they're trying to get at is they're trying to break this system of monetizing ransomware, that with this guidance, if people stop paying, hopefully they break this cycle and the criminals will go elsewhere. But in the meantime, what I think we will be seeing is if companies do abide by this, we're going to see an uptick in either, you know, maybe one of two things, an uptick of companies going out of business. If companies choose, because they're not certain of who the and what the entity is, could be on the sanctions list, could be not, don't want to take the risk. We may see an increase of companies in the short term going out of business. So that's kind of like a short term, you know, something not good happening, but for a long-term benefit of breaking kind of this cycle of criminals monetizing ransomware. The other alternative is we may see, and I don't know, I'd be interested if we could ever figure out the statistics, that this goes underground, that, you know, some way there's ways that companies will still be able to pay, but they do this in a way where the government won't be able to detect whether they're providing money to entities that may be on the sanctions list. So I'm wondering which way we'll go, whether we see more companies going out of business. I was thinking it would be great if there would be a solution that maybe the government could help some of the victims. And I couldn't come up with one. It would be great if they said, okay, if you don't pay, you're going to get some kind of, I don't know, bonus or subsidy or, I don't know, a tax break, almost kind of to help them get through what might be a very difficult financial time, or even something where they're looking at bankruptcy potentially.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I maybe want to touch on as we move along here, and I'll come back to the idea of cyber insurance, right? Whether it's the government or not involved to kind of help deal with the financial end of it. I don't know if that's possible, but Adam, I want to start with you for this next piece, which is assuming there are sanctions and there's a list of people to not, quote unquote, do business with. And one of those is a ransomware criminal that suggests that there's some attribution, perhaps, of who these folks are and how they operate. So, and it's not a switch we're going to turn off. So in the spirit of don't pay, and hopefully we break that end of the spectrum, is there a Justice Department set of actions taking place to kind of chip away at the folks and their infrastructure that they're running on?
Sure, of course. I mean, one thing about this conversation, I think it's important not to think of sanctions as the government's only tool or the answer to ransomware. Investigating ransomware attacks, understanding how the ransomware network is constituted and who's responsible for it at an individual level is the predicate on which sanctions or any other penalty could be based. So that's definitely happening. The problem is, I think you've got a lot of these groups are operating in safe havens, right? The Russian government or other governments aren't going to hold them accountable, even if we wrap all our evidence up and put a bow around it and hand it to them. So we need some other consequence that deters or shapes their behavior. One thing we'd want to do is make it harder for them to spend their money. So when we talk about cryptocurrency, sanctions aren't a great fit, right? Because they probably don't need much access to the U.S. banking system anyway. But at least it's a way of taxing or inhibiting their ability to spend their gains. And longer term, if you're only sanctioning certain ransomware actors, we're not making it illegal to pay all ransoms. There's the potential to shape behavior by those actors because you don't want to get designated, because that then could dry up the market or significantly decrease the amount of ransom you're recovering. So like any collective action problem, it looks really hard to solve from the individual perspective, because from the individual that's victimized, you feel really bad for them and you want them to be able to pay. But we are all much worse off if they're paying a designated entity, particularly if that entity is taking the revenue they generate and handing it over to the North Korean regime or Iran or some of the more traditional bad actors that we've used the sanctions authority against.
Yeah, it's not just buying a Ferrari, right? It's going to some nasty stuff.
The attribution issue ought to be particularly interesting to people who are going to RSA, because this is going to be a private sector attribution problem principally. If I'm attacked with ransomware, as I said, you've got 72 hours to decide what you're going to do. And you're going to ask your forensic, for somebody to be your incident response person, to do the forensic analysis to say, is this somebody I can't pay? And that question, you know, making that call in the first 72 hours is very hard and now very high stakes, because the people who make that call, if you say, yeah, it's okay, go ahead and pay it, and it turns out that they are a sanctioned entity, but there was some ambiguity at the time you made the decision, you still could be pursued. This is a no mens rea, no fault liability. You don't have to have done anything wrong. If you made the wrong decision, the Treasury can punish you.
Yeah, so what I love this, Stuart, and what I'm hearing you say, maybe you have some additional thoughts on this, is that it's not just an event that then gets responded to. So I guess security teams, legal teams, executives, the board perhaps even, should understand what to do in the case of a ransomware attack. So probably some tabletop exercises, practicing some response methods and following some framework, but understanding that there may be different paths to take. And I know, Marco, you wanted to touch on something related to that as well, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, the good thing about the law is that it treats everybody the same. And it's also a problem with the law in a way, when you want to think from a philosophical perspective, because everybody is not the same. So maybe, Catherine, what I would like your opinion on, and maybe you have discussed this thing during the panel, is how do we deal with different situations? So when the ransom is it's perpetrated against a business, a commercial business, it obviously is bad, even an individual. But when it's actually done to an hospital or to some infrastructure that it just can't stop, and they're not ready to react. They don't have a backup or whatever should have done before. How do we look at this from this angle?
So it's interesting you bring up the example of the hospital, because at one point, and it was last year sometime, I read something where there was, I think it was the first reported death from ransomware, and I forgot the hospital it affected, but it was somebody that, because of the ransomware, one hospital could not admit this patient and do an important life-saving procedure, but send this patient miles away to another hospital. In the meantime, the person died, and that was reported quite broadly. So, I throw this back at Adam, not to put Adam on the spot, but when I read the guidance, there's no nuance to that. But having an understanding of the government, I also appreciate that while you might read a piece of guidance that says we're all treated the same, maybe I shouldn't say this, I'm assuming, it's sometimes bad to assume, that in these cases, in going to the government, if a victim goes to the government, that I don't think the government would necessarily be looking at a potentially life-threatening situation the same they would otherwise. But that there, to me, there had to be ways that maybe not Treasury Department, but the government would be able to help that victim of the hospital. But I don't know, Adam, I'm sorry to throw it to you, but if you could probably speak to it better than I.
Sure. And I remember the example. I think it was in Germany that it happened during the pandemic last fall. So one thing that the sanctions authority, Treasury, does have the authority to issue a license. It makes very clear that the presumption is that it's going to be denied. But in a hypothetical where, you know, the ticking bomb example with ransomware, if someone's, the hospital says we can't treat anyone, all our patients will die in an hour, I think, you know, there is a mechanism to authorize that payment. And let's assume that's not enough time. I think you got to remember this guidance is aimed at forensic companies, financial providers, and the like, trying to shape their behavior going forward programmatically. It's not to retaliate against or make a victim's bad day worse. So while I can't speak for the Treasury Department, I think if you're actually confronted with the circumstance where a hospital makes the decision to pay to save patient lives because they don't have the time to investigate and they're looking at a choice between treatment and payment, I can't speak for Treasury, but that obviously is a very compelling and sympathetic case. We don't want to be in that situation, though, which is why hospitals, like any other part of our critical infrastructure, need to ensure their systems are structured and backed up in a way that that's not the choice they face, and they are responsible for doing that planning now.
And Stuart, I'm going to look to you for this piece. I want to bring it back to the cyber insurance. And to Catherine's point, if companies feel trapped, they're going to pay. Right. If they feel this is the only way to save their business, they're going to pay. And they may rely on cyber insurance to help them. I don't know if there are clauses in all of them or most of them that prevent a reimbursement for such activity or not. But
no, by and large, insurance has, you know, surprisingly, there's a lot that insurance won't cover when you have a cyber incident. But people have gotten insurance against this kind of an attack. And the insurer has reimbursed people for paying the ransom. They are going to be very reluctant to provide people assurance of reimbursement if it turns out to be a sanctioned party, of course. Okay. And so you're going to have a three-cornered discussion at least with your insurer and your forensics team and probably your legal team.
Three very sharp corners. And where I want to take that is kind of more of to the mindset. So less of the act of getting reimbursed, but just this idea that I can pay to get out of this problem, even if I'm told I shouldn't. So do we not hold a mindset that says we need to do something differently within our business, within our other entities around the U.S. and beyond, to say this isn't the right path to take?
So yeah, as we talked about on the program, everybody who's in that three or four cornered discussion, other than the person whose data has been locked up, probably has a greater incentive to say don't pay if it looks like it's a sanctioned party than the victim. So you're going to have a discussion, and all of them are looking at liability, potentially, if it's a sanctioned party. The value to them is just the value of keeping you as a client or a customer, as opposed to you of potentially losing your business. So it is a discussion in which the side that says don't pay is going to be pretty well represented.
We had conversation about cyber insurance, and I've always asked the same question. Does it become a way to not do the right thing because you have the cyber insurance as an option? So instead of being in a preventive mindset, you are in who cares?
I think your insurer usually, and especially now claims are going through the roof, your insurer is likely to start asking some pretty pointed questions about your backup procedures and about your security. That's the only good news in this entire thing, is that the insurers are potentially creating a market for good security and good backup practices, and that may be one of the reasons why we've seen the gangs move to say, okay, you say you've got backup, and so you don't need to pay. Fine, we're going to put all of your data out on the internet, which is also something that we talked about during the panel.
Yeah. So either cyber insurance or the right mindset, it should bring to what I believe to be the only solution to this, which is prevention. It's always the best choice. So Adam and Catherine,
don't connect it.
let's look a little bit into the hope for the future here as we start wrapping up here. Where are we going with this? Let's go with you, Catherine, and then Adam to close.
So I do think the right place to go is that what this whole conversation reinforces, although we're talking about ransomware, it goes beyond ransomware and even beyond the Treasury's guidance. This is really about, and it's key to the RSA conference, this is about important cyber best practices, right? That's what this all comes down to. And without those best practices, there's a world of problems, ransomware being one large one. But then, like Stuart mentioned, there's also, aside from ransomware and your data, but they could just put out on WikiLeaks or whatever, compromising, embarrassing emails. So it, for whatever reason too. So I think it goes to the heart of cybersecurity that the message is ransomware is a large issue today. It is the tool used by criminals more and more these days. There will be other tools of the future that we haven't even thought about. So it's important to realize we're going back to the genesis of cybersecurity, that years ago, when there were those scientists, the computer scientists, saying, this is how we secure our systems and our data, that's going back to the basics, that this can all be solved by taking some very important and oftentimes, surprisingly, basic steps of cyber hygiene. So I think that's where a lot of the people who are working on the field of education, promoting knowledge, getting aside from the best products out there that work, that's kind of where this whole conversation is going and is kind of the foundation. It reinforces the ransomware problem, reinforces the need for very good, modern, updated cyber best practices. So you're keeping up with the criminals, in other words.
And Adam, your final thought on this.
So I think from a government perspective, we should stay primarily focused on the things only governments can do. And to Catherine's point that if it's not ransomware, it's going to be something else, I agree. The fundamental problem here is you've got some states that are willing to turn a blind eye to crimes as long as the victims are outside those states. And so one, we can't go it alone, but I think you're seeing Europe in particular take a more muscular approach when it comes to confronting states like Russia. They have a sanctions authority, they're starting to roll it out. I think we have to think about other ways, not just financial, to bring consequences to bear on individuals who are within borders, who can't be physically reached. They have to make what they do more expensive, more difficult. we're not going to get rid of crime, but the more difficult it is to commit it and the higher the consequences, the more difficult it is to profit from it, then you can start to try to shape behavior and at least control it, and it becomes a manageable problem as opposed to something that just grows exponentially every year.
Yeah, I love this. I think the few points that I'm hearing are, one, which I think is critical, supporting those facing this, right? So give them the understanding, the education, the awareness, and perhaps even some of the tools to understand and deal with this more effectively. But I'm also hearing bring consequences to the criminals conducting this, right? And I'll say a final thought here before I do the actual final thought, which is I would encourage folks to maybe take a step back and look at their risk management program and strategy, and perhaps that point in the risk profile where you're saying we'll accept this and lean on insurance, or we'll go ahead and pay. Try to get those out of those risk plans and find an alternative way to mitigate that risk. We only scratched the surface here today, and there are three folks who've had a much deeper conversation as part of RSA Conference 365, and I want to encourage everybody to join that session. It's called Understanding Risk, Response Risk Relative to Ransomware and the Department of Trust Guidelines, and a lot more with respect to what those guidelines are, I suspect, and what it means to adhere versus violate, and perhaps even some more advice on steps forward. So 27th of January, full day event, this session part of that. Adam, Catherine, Stewart, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and giving us insight into ransomware and all that has, and a sneak peek into some things we're talking about here. Okay.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm glad we resolved the problem.
It's done. We're ransomware free.
There you go.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io. We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.